I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Since the release of the Mueller report, the Trump administration and the House of Representatives have been battling over subpoenas and executive authority. Democrats, emboldened by Mueller's descriptions of attempts by the president to obstruct justice, have called for hearings. The White House has refused to give House committees the information they have demanded and has refused to honor their subpoenas. Here's President Trump speaking to reporters outside the White House on Wednesday.
Well, we're fighting all the subpoenas. Look, these aren't like impartial people. The Democrats are trying to win 2020. They're not going to win with the people that I see, and they're not going to win against me. The only way they can maybe luck out, and I don't think that's going to happen. It might make it even the opposite. That's what a lot of people are saying. The only way they can luck out is by constantly going after me on nonsense.
Some Democrats have called for impeaching the president, while others, most notably House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, have called for a more go-slow approach. Well, today on the show, the constitutional and political battles being played out in the nation's capital. And joining us from the nation's capital, from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., is Jeffrey Rosen. He is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which I should say is our neighbor across the street in Philadelphia. Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, and I wish I were across the street.
I do,
wonderful
too.
To talk, as always.
No, we're happy to have you there, and we're happy to have Molly Ball there as well. She's national political correspondent for Time and a political analyst for CNN. Molly Ball, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. There is so much to talk about. Jeffrey, let me just start with a kind of broad-based question here. Are we staring at some kind of constitutional crisis?
The definition of a constitutional crisis is hotly contested, but if the definition is that the branches are so much at odds that there's violence in the streets, which was the case during the Civil War and the founding, no, we're not yet at a constitutional crisis. But we do face the possibility, with the clip you just heard, we're going to fight all the subpoenas, of real constitutional conflict between the Congress and the president, assertions of executive privilege, new precedents about the scope of Congress's investigatory power, and those conflicts could indeed go up to the Supreme Court.
And I, of course, want to talk about all of that. Molly, what does the House want? What does the House want from the White House?
Well, a lot of things. They have made a number of requests to various members of the administration. There are a bunch of investigations going on by six different House committees ever since the Democrats won the 2018 midterms and took over the House of Representatives. They have been determined to act as a check on the Trump administration and to perform their oversight responsibility, which is a legitimate part of their duties, but and which they accused the Republicans when they held the House of not having done for the first 2 years of the Trump administration. But the White House has chosen to depict this as, quote, presidential harassment, and to resist it as much as possible, rather than taking the approach, say, that, you know, the president has nothing to hide, therefore he will make everybody available. It's clear that they don't view these investigations and perhaps the oversight power in general as legitimate in any way, and the president continues to insist that he was cleared by the Mueller report. But of course, there are many questions raised by the Mueller report, and then aside from that, many other areas that the Democrats want to look into, whether we're talking about the several cabinet secretaries who have now resigned in disgrace and a cloud of corruption, or the president's finances, or many other issues.
Yeah, the president's finances, also wanting to talk to former White House counsel Donald McGahn, looking at the president's tax records, and even looking at the security clearance process that was at the White House. Jeffrey, let me go back to you, and to go back to what kind of authority then the House of Representatives has to provide oversight over the White House. What should we know about that?
The case to check out is an obscure case called McCrane versus Daugherty, 1927. It was the Teapot Dome scandal. Daugherty was the brother of the former attorney general who was refusing to prosecute wrongdoing, and Congress subpoenaed the brother. And the question was, did Congress have the power to do it, since the investigation had nothing to do with the committees legislative purpose. And in that case, which is the Supreme Court's main statement on the scope of Congress's subpoena power, it essentially said that each house of Congress has the power to force individuals to appear before it in order to efficiently exercise a legislative function belonging to it under the Constitution, but it can't use its subpoena power for general investigation. It doesn't have a general power to inquire into private affairs and compel disclosures. So the basic question is, are the subpoenas related to some other power granted to Congress, some oversight power or appropriations power, or is it just meddling for its own sake? Now, other cases have construed this pretty broadly, and many of the subpoenas that are now pending might well fall under this idea of Congress exercising its legislative power of oversight, which is granted to it under the Constitution. But that's likely to be the central distinction if these subpoenas get before the courts.
I mean, it seems that a lot of these subpoenas are related to either the Mueller report, Mueller investigation, or even what the Southern District of New York might be looking at. Taking this Teapot Dome scandal as our rubric here, Jeffrey, then, how do you see then what the House is looking for, specifically about the president's taxes or what he told McGahn to do or not do?
Well, you know, as Molly said, there are so many aspects to this, but any subpoenas related to the Mueller report, what he told McGahn, did he try to fire McGahn, what he did to Corey Lewandowski and so forth, all of those are part of Congress's oversight power. They can be seen as part of a potential impeachment proceeding, whether or not Congress decides to impeach. And therefore, Congress certainly has a strong argument that those individuals should appear. If the president were to plead executive privilege, which he hasn't done yet, the argument would be, sorry, you've already waived that because you already allowed Don McGahn to testify before Mueller. You can't now claim that those conversations are privileged because Mueller has already heard about them. So anything that Mueller has written about, it will be relatively easy for Congress to get the individuals who've already talked about it to Mueller to talk about it to Congress.
Let me just pick up one thing, and Molly, go to you. And I'm just quoting here from Elijah Cummings. He's the head of the Oversight Committee, and issued a statement saying both President Trump and Attorney General Barr are now openly ordering federal employees to ignore congressional subpoenas and simply not show up without any assertion of a valid legal privilege. These employees and their personal attorneys should think very carefully about their own legal interests rather than being swept up in the obstruction schemes of the Trump administration. What is he saying there?
Well, he's saying that there could be consequences for the individuals involved if they don't obey these subpoenas. And as Jeffrey was saying, the legal stuff here is very complicated. Yeah. But and as a non-lawyer, I would not want to opine on that. But from the Democrats' perspective, you know, this administration poses a threat to the rule of law and to the checks and balances guaranteed in the Constitution. And the disrespect for congressional oversight is of a piece with that. Now, the Republicans obviously don't agree with that perspective. And when you go back to the Obama administration, it's an interesting precedent here because the Republican Congress conducted a number of investigations, long-running investigations of the Obama administration. And in some cases, they were stonewalled. So, you know, whether or not something is a legitimate investigation can depend on your perspective. But ultimately, the courts are going to have to be the arbiter of whether these people can be compelled to appear.
Well, so Jeffrey, if someone from the White House ignores a subpoena or is told to ignore a subpoena, then it goes to the courts and the courts decide?
The courts decide and the courts can hold the person who refuses to appear in contempt, which is why Molly is absolutely right to say these individuals should be concerned about their own legal jeopardy, and contempt is a serious thing and you can be put in jail and so forth. So these are very significant conflicts and we could see some real drama.
We could see some real drama. I mean, I think we are really seeing a lot of drama. And Molly, I realize that Congress is on vacation, but what is the sort of overall mood down there in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, well, the Democrats, the House Democrats held a conference call over the weekend to talk about the Mueller report and field questions about impeachment. As you said, they don't come back until next week, and that's when we'll really get a read on it. But what we are seeing is more and more Democratic members of Congress, privately and publicly, talking about impeachment as a real possibility. To do a little bit of self-promotion here, I wrote a cover story for Time magazine more than
right
a month
here.
Ago,
yes, you do.
arguing for impeachment, but this is a reported analysis assessing the situation and making the case that impeachment was all but inevitable, regardless of what was in the Mueller report, simply because so many Democrats believe that there is already very ample evidence of a president who has abused the Constitution and abused his power. So they are proceeding with these investigations. I interviewed Speaker Nancy Pelosi just a few days ago, and she continues to hold the line that there must be a very, very, very high standard for impeachment. But I would argue that these investigations they're conducting, and Jeffrey basically said this, are impeachment hearings in all but name, similar to Watergate, when there were Watergate hearings for more than a year before it ever became officially an impeachment process. They are looking into all of these things, and they want to convey to the public that they haven't prejudged the evidence. But many Democrats believe that that's where this is headed.
And we certainly will spend the rest of the hour talking about impeachment and some of the history lessons and also what the Constitution says. But to you, Jeffrey, how much is the president then protected from lawsuits? And this has certainly come up. And it came up even in the Mueller report. It seemed as if Mueller had to kind of pull his punches, I guess, because of the fact that the president is protected in a certain kind of way from some of these suits.
Yes. As you say, Mueller appears to have decided not to reach a judgment about whether or not the president obstructed justice because of longstanding Justice Department policy that the president can't be indicted while he's in office. But the president is, as we've been discussing, liable to impeachment and can be investigated for those reasons. He's also liable to the civil suits, which are proceeding in the Southern District and elsewhere, and everyone that he talked to or may have interacted with who could have allegedly obstructed justice as well is liable to being investigated and possibly prosecuted. So there's certainly plenty for Congress to engage in. And really viewing these hearings, as Molly says, whether it's viewed as a prelude to impeachment or just part of Congress's oversight hearings, which are part of its constitutional responsibilities, which could lead to a penalty short of impeachment, like censure or something like that, is a justification for collecting a lot of evidence.
Jeffrey, we're almost up on a break here, but you said this is a policy. So it's not a law. It hasn't been tested in the courts about how the president or any president is protected from lawsuits.
That's right. It's a policy. It's been criticized by people, including Ken Starr, the former independent counsel for President Clinton. So not everyone agrees. Indeed, Justice Brett Kavanaugh at one point had questioned whether or not the president could be indicted while in office. But nevertheless, because it's settled policy, this president will not be indicted while he's in office, although he is liable for possible prosecution after he leaves office for the alleged wrongdoing outlined in the Mueller report.
That's Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, joining us along with Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time and a political analyst for CNN, joining us on Radio Time to talk about some of the battles, some of the constitutional legal battles that are taking place down in Washington, D.C. between the White House and the House of Representatives. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Molly Ball and Jeffrey Rosen about some of the battles between the White House and the House of Representatives over subpoenas, executive privilege hearings, and calls for impeachment. We went back in history yesterday and pulled out this pretty extraordinary clip from Representative Barbara Jordan. She was a Democrat from Texas, opening statement at the House Judiciary Committee hearing to consider articles of impeachment against President Nixon. And this, of course, was many years ago, July 25th, 1974. And it is considered one of the great speeches of the 20th century. This is just about 40 seconds.
Common sense would be revolted if we engaged upon this process for petty reasons. Congress has a lot to do. appropriations, tax reform, health insurance, campaign finance reform, housing, environmental protection, energy sufficiency, mass transportation. Pettiness cannot be allowed to stand in the face of such overwhelming problems. So today we're not being petty. We're trying to be big, because the task we have before us is a big one.
Oh, it gives me chills. And I should say, we posted the whole speech on our Facebook page so our listeners can listen to it. But Jeffrey Rosen, I think I heard you make a noise, put it that way.
Just hearing Barbara Jordan's voice, she appears in Freedom Rising, the inspiring show when you go to the Constitution Center, talking about how she originally was not considered one of We the People. And that voice is so inspiring. She was such a voice of constitutional conscience. It does give you chills.
In fact, she goes on to say, and I can't use her voice, of course, the framers confined in the Congress the power, if need be, to remove the president in order to strike a delicate balance between a president swollen with power and grown tyrannical and preservation of the independence of the executive. Jeffrey, what is she saying there?
She's saying that the impeachment power was originally conceived not just as a means of enforcing criminal laws, but of ensuring that the president faithfully executed the laws and was not corrupt. And what I want listeners to do, if you're in Philly, as I'm going to be on Monday, go to the Constitution Center. You can see one of the five earliest drafts of the Constitution written by James Wilson. And the original draft of the impeachment clause said treason, bribery, or corruption. Of course, the final draft says, or high crimes and misdemeanors. But corruption was the paradigmatic example of something for which the president could be impeached, not faithfully executing the laws, being susceptible to foreign influences in particular. That was the central concern, as well as trying to undermine the execution of the rule of law for personal gain rather than in the public interest. That was the central distinction that the framers made. And Madison in Federalist 10 talks about the need to serve the public good rather than private interest. So without making a judgment about, you know, what anyone should do, it's fascinating to look at that history and to realize that the original conception of the impeachment power, as Barbara Jordan said so powerfully, was quite broad.
Well, let me play another clip, and this is you, Molly Ball, speaking with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Tuesday night. This is in front of a live audience at the Time 100 Summit, discussing some of the questions of whether or not to impeach President Trump. Let's give it a listen.
I do believe that impeachment is one of the most divisive forces, paths that we could go down to in our country. But if the facts, the path of fact-finding takes us there, we have no choice. But we're not there yet. And as I said, I've said in my letter, I said to my members, I say to you, as I said earlier, there are many ways to hold the president accountable. The Congress, the Justice Department may have not decided to use its full power to impeach, to indict. Congress will not be silent in terms of using our constitutional power to find the facts for the American people.
I mean, Molly, it's so interesting because she's trying to go, I take a very sort of narrow path between all the things that are happening today.
Yeah, and she's consistently tried to thread this needle. Many people have heard her to say that she's against impeachment, but she's never said that, and she's never ruled it out. She's never taken it off the table. What she has tried to do, and I've followed her words very closely on this, she's tried to set a very high bar, particularly because of that divisiveness. She was in Congress during the Clinton impeachment, and many of the members now, the senators and congressmen today, were there, and they bear the scars of that. And the Democrats in particular feel that that was not a warranted process, and that it was undertaken for political reasons, and that it not only was tremendously divisive for the entire country, but that it backfired politically on the Republicans, made people more sympathetic to a president who literally used the words witch hunt and depicted himself as being harassed by an out-of-control, partisan, Republican-driven process. So the Democrats don't want to do that. But what Pelosi has consistently said, she said, we're not going to impeach for political reasons, and we're not going to not impeach for political reasons, even if it becomes clear that this is going to be a a political loser for the Democrats. They will do it if they have to, if they feel compelled by the law and by the Constitution. I think they would rather run out the clock, because there is an election only a year and a half away, leave this judgment to the voters. They don't want to appear to be taking away the judgment that the voters made in 2016. But the standard that Pelosi has set is, number one, there has to be support from the public. She hasn't said how much support. But right now, it's generally 40-45% of the public believes that Trump should be impeached and removed. And that's before the Congress has really gotten going on holding these hearings. And then the other standard she said is there has to be Republican support. She's not going to do this as a simply Democrats going after a Republican president.
Well, Jeffrey, I certainly remember the Watergate hearings, and they were hearings, and they were held on, you know, you could hear them on public television, public radio as well. And just the airing of all that information and what we learned about what was actually happening in the White House, it seemed like that really changed public opinion, although we should say that Nixon resigned before he was impeached. But are there lessons from Watergate that we can at least think about for today?
There are, and they confirm Speaker Pelosi's point that you need public support and bipartisan support to have an effective impeachment. The Nixon case was interesting. Elizabeth Drew, who covered Watergate, recently noted that the original articles against President Nixon were for investigating the tax returns of his opponents. And the infamous June 23rd tape where he ordered the cover-up didn't come out until after the proceeding had started. And that very much transformed public opinion, brought Republicans on board. And once Nixon counted the votes and realized he didn't have enough support to survive, he resigned. So that all confirms the speaker's insight that impeachment is a process, and that by laying out the facts, public opinion might or might not change. But there's a virtue merely to the investigation, because you can test whether or not the public thinks that high crimes have been committed or not.
Well, two presidents have been impeached. That would be Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. But no one has been convicted by the Senate. Jeffrey, is that significant?
It's very significant. Both the Clinton and the Johnson impeachments are broadly seen as failed and misguided. The Johnson impeachment was brought over Johnson's failure to obey the Tenure in Office Act by firing his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton. Later, that act was struck down by the Supreme Court in an opinion by Chief Justice William Howard Taft, U.S. versus Myers, as being unconstitutional. So basically, the thought was Johnson's real sin was obstructing Reconstruction, refusing to enforce the Reconstruction amendments. And by bringing the impeachment on this technical law that later proved to be unconstitutional, it was right that he was acquitted. And the Clinton impeachment, as you suggested, was viewed by Democrats and by Republicans, who perhaps saw the political backlash in favor of Clinton, as having been ill-advised as well. So the bar is high, and that's why we're in such uncharted waters when Democrats say we should look not merely for technical violations of the obstruction of justice laws or the conspiracy laws, but of a general attempt to subvert the rule of law, to fail to take care that the law is faithfully executed. They're not able to point to any historic analogs, because we haven't had one, and that's what makes this debate so crucially important.
Well, as you both seem to say, Molly, is that we're sort of having these hearings, even if we're not calling them impeachment hearings. But how close do you think we are to having McGahn testify before a congressional committee about what he told Mueller, or perhaps what he and the president talked about?
I don't know, but I think what you see from McGahn's role in the Mueller report is that he's a very serious lawyer and someone who has very serious respect for legal responsibilities. At multiple points, he prevented the president from doing things that he viewed as illegal. He cooperated with the investigation because he viewed it as his responsibility to do so. So this is not there are some people in the administration who I think have a less formal respect, you might say, for the letter of the law. And Don McGahn is not one of those people. Right. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him testify. And I think we have seen these blockbuster hearings really transfix the American public, whether it was the Comey hearing last year or the Michael Cohen hearing more recently. These hearings have the potential to really, as Jeffrey was saying, put evidence in front of the public in a very powerful way. Mm-hmm. And I think The point that he was making about corruption is also really interesting. I, for my impeachment analysis, did a really deep dive into public opinion and how the public is viewing not just the Mueller investigation, but all of this oversight. And what Democratic pollsters who've been testing this have found is that the public is by far the most bothered by the potential for corruption, by the idea that the president may be feathering his own nest rather than looking after the well-being of the country. And that is not something that was addressed very much in the Mueller report, with the possible exception of the Trump Tower Moscow affair. But that is something I think you'll see Democrats really hammering on, more so than even the campaign finance violation for which the president is presently an unindicted co-conspirator, simply because the public views that as more of a technicality, whereas the corruption is potentially seen as serious.
And just a quick follow-up there. You looked at some focus groups. This was, I think, even before the release of the Mueller report, finding Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals coming together on their worry about and criticism of corruption.
That's right. And these focus groups, I should point out, were not the general public. These were selected groups of people who were thought to be sort of in the middle, soft Democrats, soft Republicans, and independents in Iowa, talking about what they anticipated from the Mueller report. And as we've consistently seen, people haven't been following it extremely closely. But they certainly felt that there was some there. And I think that's why you haven't seen public opinion change very much in the wake of either the Barr letter or the Mueller report, is that despite the president's claims of having been cleared, people broadly think that there was some kind of wrongdoing. And they have not been swayed very much by the president's arguments that he is fully exonerated. And so I think the Democrats are on somewhat firm ground with public opinion as they continue to look into this, as they continue to try to find more facts and put them before the public.
That's Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time, joining us along with Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. They're both down in the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Let me just read a couple of comments. We've got some folks that want to join the conversation as well. An email from Greg. Who would need to exercise the authority to arrest individuals for ignoring subpoenas from Congress? Jeffrey, is that what we are looking at potentially?
That's a great question. I don't know if it's a technical thing where the marshal of the House or something, that the House has its own enforcement authorities, or whether if it's a federal district court, just the officers of the court would do so and it would be ordinary law enforcement. There's a right and wrong answer to that question. And if you email me at jrosenconstitutioncenter.org, our great constitutional prep team can get you the right answer.
Oh, fair enough. And we will post.
Wow, stumped Jeffrey
yeah,
Rosen.
Absolutely.
I never thought I'd see the day.
No,
that doesn't
do.
Happen
That's
every
how I'm trying to
every
territory.
Single day.
We're going to make note of this day, Jeffrey Rosen.
No.
Here's an email from Paul. If a president were to commit a serious crime, such as a capital crime, while in office, is he still beyond the reach of the law? Jeffrey.
If you were to commit a capital crime.
A capital crime. I mean, you know, something really super serious. Like shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. Just
yes.
To, you know.
Oh, good question. Yes, even if he were to commit a capital crime, the Justice Department opinion says that he would have to be indicted after he left office. So he could certainly be impeached for the capital crime, and then he could be indicted and convicted after that. But if he shot someone on Fifth Avenue, he could not immediately be indicted or convicted.
I'm fascinated. Let me get to Juan, and Juan is calling us from Fishtown. And go ahead, Juan, you're on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning. Thanks
morning.
For having me.
Sure, go ahead.
I had a couple questions, but I was just wondering, how can you, president just tell people to ignore a subpoena, and then also, can I ignore a court order also, or is it just... You have to have that executive privilege to just tell the courts
to go jump in a lake. And no, I hear you, Juan. It's a good question, and I think one that we should all know the answer to. Jeffrey, can I toss that back to you?
Great question. Yes, generally, you cannot ignore a subpoena, especially from Congress, unless you can come up with some good reason for doing so. So you might have a spousal privilege or a psychiatric privilege and so forth, or you could claim that the subpoena was too broad, as President Clinton did in challenging his subpoena, and courts might balance your privacy interests against the investigative interest of Congress. But unless a court decided that the subpoena was unduly burdensome and unreasonable and violated the Fourth Amendment, then you would have to comply. Generally, the president can't tell people not to testify unless he's asserting a privilege that belongs to himself, like executive privilege. So that's why the president can't prevent Donald Trump Jr. from testifying about conversations he may have had with his father before President Trump became president, because right. executive privilege only covers right. conversations in the White House itself. It has a limited scope.
Molly, you've covered a number of administrations. Is this one any more resistant to having members of the administration testify or giving up documents or resisting subpoenas?
Yes, by far. I don't think previous administrations have been this overt and this universal in their resistance to congressional oversight. Certainly there have been administrations, you mentioned the Clinton administration, that have fought subpoenas that they've viewed as illegitimate or for whatever reason. But I just wanted to say one other
sure.
thing about what the caller said,
sure.
Which is this is the thing that consistently bothers people about Trump's actions, is this idea that the president considers himself above the law. And that is something that resonates very broadly with Democrats, with Republicans, with independents. People do not like the idea that the president might be putting himself above the law. And so I think that is also an argument that that you can expect to, mm-hmm. to continue to hear.
But in certain ways, Jeffrey, he is above the law. I mean, he and previous presidents are above the law.
Well, he's not supposed to be.
No, I know he's not supposed to be, but it seems like the law gives him a certain dispensation.
Well, the immunity, which again is not is contested, some people disagree with it, is based on the idea that it would just take up so much of his time if any district court could compel him on charges that might not be plausible. But he's always amenable to the law in the sense of impeachment. And that's why Congress's oversight role is crucially important in assuring that the president is not above the law. And when President Nixon said, if the president does it, it's not illegal, Congress disagreed. And that was the whole point of impeachment.
And that is Jeffrey Rosen, again, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is here in Philadelphia. In fact, right across the street from WHYY. Molly Ball joining us as well. She's national political correspondent for Time. She's also a political analyst for CNN. And we are talking about this battle between the White House and the House of Representatives. Do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Molly Ball and Jeffrey Rosen about some of the constitutional and political battles that are being played out in Washington, D.C., battles between the House of Representatives and the White House. Let me play one more clip, and this is Representative Adam Schiff. He chairs the House Intelligence Committee, and he's speaking with Martha Raddatz on ABC's This Week, this past Sunday, about whether or not the Democrats should begin impeachment proceedings.
I think what we are going to have to decide as a caucus is, what is the best thing for the country? Is the best thing for the country to take up an impeachment proceeding? Because to do otherwise sends a message that this conduct is somehow compatible with office. Or is it in the best interest of the country not to take up an impeachment that we know will not be successful in the Senate because the Republican leadership will not do its duty? That's a very tough question. And I think it's we ought not to make overnight.
I wonder, Molly, just how much pressure on Schiff and Cummings and some other Democratic leaders in the House coming from their members who really want to bring on impeachment hearings and they really want to impeach the president?
Well, there have been resolutions of impeachment introduced. I believe three separate members of Congress have done this, and some of them not for the first time. There's been Democratic members calling for Trump's impeachment since the beginning or since his first 2 years, since before the Mueller report came out. There is some pressure, and I think it is increasing as the Mueller report has now been released and as more facts are put on the table. But it is never a good bet to question Nancy Pelosi's control over the Democratic caucus. She's very good at what she does. good at keeping her people together, good at persuading them to go along with her approach to things. And in this case, I think even though there's a range of opinions in the Congress about whether to proceed with impeachment, there is a general buy-in to the approach that the Speaker has taken, which is that thread-the-needle approach we talked about of keeping impeachment on the table but trying to get the investigation put before the public first. So there's also pressure from the Democratic base. You know, the liberal billionaire Tom Steyer has spent $100 million on a pro-impeachment campaign.
Wow.
Including a
million.
Lot of television. Yep. Television ads, a grassroots movement. More than 7 million people have signed his online petition calling for Trump's impeachment. He had these activists go to Capitol Hill with this card listing 10 allegedly impeachable offenses that he claims Trump has already been proven to have committed. This was back in January, and give these to all of the Democratic members of Congress. He's even gone after individual members who he felt were not moving fast enough, airing ads criticizing them in their districts. Wow. So he believes passionately that the Congress needs to move forward sooner, not later. And there certainly is a vocal portion of the Democratic base that believes that.
Well, we've also got Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and a couple of other presidential candidates, Molly, also basically saying it's time to impeach.
That's right, although I would say that answering the question that way is different than, you know, calling Nancy Pelosi and lobbying her personally that
sure.
she needs to move faster on this.
Sure.
And those senators are not doing that. What they're doing is they're getting the question from a journalist and they're giving their honest opinion. But what we don't see is a lot of actual push for this to happen. I think there's a feeling that if it's going to happen, it'll happen more or less organically. And so the question is, does this get dragged out as a process? And part of that also is the White House response, right? When you have a White House that is trying to stonewall the oversight process, can they succeed even if they don't succeed at the end of the day in the courts and they are ordered to cooperate with the subpoenas, they can delay it substantially. They can get this tied up in legal proceedings. They do have still have a few good lawyers over there, and they're making arguments about whether, you know, the president is going to need to turn over his tax returns, for example, or rather the IRS is going to need to turn over the president's tax returns. And so at the very least, they hope to delay that substantially. And we've heard administration members claim that they believe they can delay it so far that it will be after the election by the time any of this comes up.
And that's Molly Ball joining us along with Jeffrey Rosen. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about some of the political, legal, constitutional battles that are taking place in Washington. Jeffrey, let me go back to you. And there have been two impeachments in U.S. history, one involving Andrew Johnson, one involving Bill Clinton. Can we say that the Bill Clinton impeachment is how not to do impeachment?
Yes. Impeaching a president over a technical violation of a law that doesn't seem to get at the root of the corruption that Molly was talking about. And that was really such an interesting insight that she had, that that's what the public is resonating to, doesn't tend to work. By contrast, the Nixon impeachment, which, of course, was never formally voted, was a successful one because it really did go to corruption and to a fundamental assault on the rule of law. So all that suggests that although the forthcoming hearings may focus on important legal questions about whether Mueller's findings of obstruction rose to the level of probable cause or reasonable suspicion of obstruction of justice, and as Democrats are reading the report closely, they're understanding that Mueller's team was much more explicit about saying there was strong evidence of obstruction than the Attorney General had suggested, that may not be enough to move the needle on public opinion,
right?
Because even formal findings of obstruction don't amount to the kind of corruption that people really resonate with.
Although, if more thing about public opinion, something that was very striking in these focus groups that I watched is that people do care about obstruction of justice, that, you know, the president and his allies have tried to make the case that obstruction is a quote-unquote process crime, that it is something of a technicality, that it is akin to going after Bill Clinton for lying under oath, which the public broadly viewed as a sort of understandable fib about an affair he didn't want people to know about, whether or not you agree with that. But this attempt to create the public impression that obstruction is a mere technicality, people do view obstruction of justice as a pretty serious thing. They don't really know what it is. They couldn't give you chapter and verse on what it means to obstruct justice, but it sounds serious, and people don't like the idea that it is something that the president did.
Well, and just to put a point on this, the president wanted Don McGahn to fire Mueller, which McGahn refused to do. He, of course, was the White House counsel at the time. And he also wanted him to create a document to deny that the president had ordered him to fire Mueller, something else that he refused to do. So while it seems like there were these attempts, there were members of the administration or Corey Lewandowski who didn't carry out what the president wanted them to do. Jeffrey, does the Constitution help us understand this or give us any guidance?
Well, if our paradigmatic offenses are treason, bribery, corruption, or other high crimes of misdemeanors, we could say that an attempt by the president to order the firing of agent in order to protect himself rather than execute the rule of law is an example of corruption, and whether or not it rises to the level of violating federal criminal statutes. And there are these really technical, really important questions that listeners should dig into and make up their own mind about whether the president can corruptly exercise one of his constitutional powers, like the power to fire an inferior officer. That's a question on which Mueller and the attorney general disagreed. Despite all that, when you just step back, Molly's telling us that the public thinks obstruction is serious, and if there were hearings where Don McGahn testified about how the president had wanted him to fire Mueller and he refused, it's possible that people would see that as the kind of corruption that the Constitution is trying to protect. And the broad question is, you know, the one we're talking about, is the president above the law? And if people think the president's trying to make himself above the law by firing aides or stopping investigations, that might resonate. Now the difficult thing here is there are the legal questions that Mueller and the Democrats have to reach, and the political questions. And impeachment is a complicated blend of legal and political questions, which is what makes the Democrats' task about whether or not to impeach so very difficult and challenging.
Here's an email from Fred. He says, if McGahn, he's now in private practice, as I understand, but was the White House counsel. If McGahn is now a private citizen, how can Trump prevent him from testifying? Which is an interesting, can I toss it back to you, Jeffrey? And Molly, if you want to weigh in, I'd be interested in what you had to say as well.
Yes, even though McGahn is now a private citizen, if his conversations with the president were privileged, in other words, there was a legal protection against him discussing the private deliberations that he had with the president, then the president could assert executive privilege and prevent a private citizen from testifying about stuff he talked about in the White House. However, and the relevant case here is U.S. versus Nixon, where Nixon tried to assert the privilege and the court said there is a privilege for internal deliberations, there's a privilege for conversations about foreign policy and foreign leaders, but you can't just refuse to talk in all circumstances. The thing here, though, is that Trump has already waived or refused to exercise executive privilege over those conversations, so he can't retrospectively exercise it.
And Molly, he, meaning McGahn, apparently spoke with Mueller's team for something like 30 hours, and I read that he's mentioned 500 times in the Mueller report. So obviously a key person here.
Yeah, a very significant figure, potentially, well, already a significant figure, and could become more so, I think. You have a lot of Democrats hoping that McGahn will become the sort of John Dean figure of this whole saga, the one who, you know, is moved by his conscience to turn against the administration. And I don't think we know yet whether he is willing to go quite that far, but we have seen other cases of whistleblowers from within the administration coming forward, for example, on the security clearance issue. And that is another tool at the Democrats' disposal, is when there are people, people like Michael Cohen, who perhaps were once in Trump's inner circle, but have decided that they are troubled by what they see, they are able to come forward, and the Democrats will be more than happy to give them a forum as well.
Well, it's always tricky with Michael Cohen because he's, you know, known for saying things that are not true. So do you believe, Molly, in a sense, do you believe a liar?
Right. And that's the question. It was very interesting. There was some polling after the Michael Cohen hearings that people believed Michael Cohen more than they believed Trump, despite the fact that Michael Cohen is going to jail for lying. That may tell you more about the president's credibility at the present moment than Michael Cohen's. But that is, you know, as any the Democrats are sort of in the position of a prosecutor here, putting on witnesses before the jury, that is the American public, and trying to create a narrative that is believable despite the imperfections that come along with any particular witness. So it's up to them to structure this and to decide who they put in that spotlight.
Jeffrey, let me quote the president. He says, in caps, "I did nothing wrong. If the partisan Dems," this sounds like a tweet, "if the partisan Dems ever tried to impeach, I would first head to the U.S. Supreme Court." Now, well, first of all, is that how the process works?
It's not. This is a question where I don't feel stumped, and I'm confident in saying that the Supreme Court has no role in impeachment, aside from the fact that the Chief Justice would preside over any potential impeachment trial in the Senate. The impeachment is viewed as an entirely separate constitutional track. If the president were to challenge the constitutionality of his impeachment, the court would refuse to hear the case and would say essentially that impeachment is whatever the House says it is, as Representative Gerald Ford famously said. So that particular tweet is based on a mistaken view of the Constitution and the law.
This is Mark joining us from New Jersey. And Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is earlier in the program, there was discussion about the DOJ policy shielding the president from indictment. And my question is does that protection extend to state charges?
Jeffrey, do you have an answer to that?
I do, and it doesn't.
And it doesn't.
The president is liable to state charges, so all of those investigations in the Southern District can indeed proceed.
I appreciate
but I should say those are state civil charges. He is immune from indictment for criminal charges.
Mark, thanks for the call. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. I'm almost afraid to bring up the emoluments clause only because it's complicated. But nonetheless, I think it should be part of our conversation. And Jeffrey, in the couple of minutes that we have left, and to you, Molly, as well, I realize this is not part of what's being discussed, but it seems like something that maybe I just don't understand why this is not a more important issue.
Well, I'll just put in a plug for the National Constitution Center's Interactive Constitution, which you can find online or in the App Store. It has great essays on the Emoluments Clause by Zephyr Teachout and Barrett Tillman, which explain what the top liberal and conservative scholars of the clause agree and disagree. There is some disagreement about whether the Emoluments Clause even applies to the president. Alexander Hamilton said it didn't, but every president since Jackson has assumed it did apply to him, and President Obama assumed it applied to him when he decided to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. The challenges essentially are that President Trump is benefiting from his hotels and that rival hotels that are losing business to foreign businesses that are staying in his hotels and benefiting from them are harmed as a result. And those cases are working themselves up through the lower courts. They're on a bunch of different tracks. None has a clear answer yet. We don't yet have a disagreement among the circuits, but those are among the many, I guess you'd call them civil lawsuits that will continue to bubble up. And those can proceed while the president's in office. So if any court did find a violation of the clause, then that could indeed lead to legal consequences for the president.
So, Molly, are you buckled up for the next 6 months to a year to more?
Absolutely. I think we all are in the press. But, you know, this emoluments issue is really interesting. The courts have not stopped any of these lawsuits. They are going forward. This is a live question. So in the Congress as well as in the courts, this is something that's being examined. And Jeffrey can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand, it's a relatively untested area of the law. So it'll be very interesting to see how that goes.
Well, we'll have to revisit that. My thanks to both of you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Molly Ball, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And she's national political correspondent for Time. Jeffrey Rosen, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. President and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.